It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Democrats will officially regain control in the U.S. House of Representatives in January. Pennsylvania will send 9 Democrats to the House, including Congressman Mike Doyle, who just won his 13th term in office. 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins sat down with Doyle to talk about his legislative goals, including health care.
It's funny how the same issue that probably unseated 61 of us back in 2010 was the same issue that we basically won this election by, because people finally now understand what it means to go back to a system where insurance companies can discriminate against you because you're sick. And every Republican had become an instant convert to pre-existing conditions. It was remarkable to see the epiphany that occurred within that party once they realized the public got this. And I think we want this period of new Democratic leadership in the House to be one initially where we really start an education campaign to start to get public buy-in and understanding and acceptance of things like a climate change plan. These are issues that, you know, we just aren't going to pass right away because of the makeup of the Senate and the presidency, but it gives us a forum to have a voice and have an agenda that we can put forward to the public and make that, you know, the battleground for the 2020 election too.
How useful is it to have that kind of ambitious progressive agenda when Republicans do control the Senate and President Trump has another 2 years in the White House?
Well, I think that we have to be realistic about what's in front of us. This is a tremendous opportunity for us to garner public buy-in and acceptance. Pre-existing conditions, I go back to health care. Whether you're a Republican, an independent, or a Democrat, and you look at polling on that, people are for that, right? Because they finally understand what it means. It's the same with climate change. We have to break this down into segments where people start to understand why it's important to make these kinds of changes and investments. Now, this isn't going to happen just because Democrats took over the House of Representatives, and it's not going to happen next month. So I think for a lot of us, we're begging for the time to set the stage for us to be able to eventually pass legislation like this and hopefully get a president that will sign it.
What areas do you feel need more oversight? Do you sense that there are common goals within the Democratic Party and in the House as far as pursuing specific investigations?
I think we want to have a sense that nobody has undue influence over our president. He has been reluctant to reveal his tax returns, as every other president has done. This leads to suspicion. Not so much, does he have investments in other countries, but do other countries have investments in him? I think people have a right to know that. Now, the House Ways and Means Committee has subpoena power to look at the president's tax returns to see whether or not there's any potential conflicts that do exist that could impact our national security. You know, when the president is strangely silent with the Saudis under the recent execution of a journalist in Turkey, when the president seems unwilling or unable to have anything critical to say about Putin and Russia, it raises a certain amount of questions as to why that is. When the rest of his party, by the way, has been quite vocal, not all of them, but many of them in the party, about what's going on in Saudi Arabia right now and what's been going on with regards to Russia and how they're trying to influence elections, not only in our country, but all across the world. And Republicans, quite frankly, have been unwilling to exercise their oversight responsibilities on this president.
Do you see areas for Democrats and Republicans in Congress to compromise on? That's something that we heard a lot after the election from both sides in this extremely divided era of politics that we're in, that Democrats and Republicans need to come together. What issues do you see that you could compromise with a conservative member of Congress on, and if you have any specific legislation?
Yeah, sure. Infrastructure is always brought up as an area for compromise. You know, roads and bridges and the electric grid and broadband deployment aren't Democratic or Republican issues. They're issues we all care about. When we talk about infrastructure, we're talking about a comprehensive piece of infrastructure that would not just be roads and bridges, but would be our water and sewer systems, would be the electric grid, would be broadband deployment in unserved and underserved areas of the country. This takes revenue. And I think that's where the fights come in, right? How do you pay for these things? Mm-hmm. But I think there's a real will in the Congress to do it. Immigration. The Senate passed a comprehensive immigration bill with 68 votes that continues to sit over in the House of Representatives. I believe that if that bill were on the floor today, it would not only get most every Democratic vote, but it would get 60 or 70 or 80 Republican votes if it were put on the floor for a vote. Paul Ryan wouldn't let the bill come to the floor. Gun legislation. I mean, how many tragedies have to happen, now one in our own city, before we can sit down as a country and say, aren't there some things we can agree upon? I mean, I would go a lot further than a lot of members would. I see no civilian purpose for weapons that are military-style weapons.
That's one thing I wanted to ask you about. I saw you at the press conference after the Tree of Life shooting, and that's why I wanted to talk to you about gun control legislation.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. This happens over and over, and I guess I'm just wondering how realistic you actually think legislation surrounding this is. I mean, you know, after Parkland, President Trump invited survivors of gun violence to come and talk about reform, and some people were hopeful then, and some people said, you know, nothing's going to happen this time either. So, yeah.
It's really hard to be optimistic about it because we've been disappointed so many times. When those young children were slaughtered in Connecticut, I thought this is it. This is so horrific, so unthinkable that, you know, we're going to get something done. My own city, the most horrific slaughter of Jews in the history of our country. I mean, good Lord, what more has to happen before we can talk? I mean, we don't even get a chance to vote on the bills. And I would hope, as the Democrats now control the House, that we at least put members on record. Okay, so it's never going to pass the Senate, or the president won't sign it. Who knows, after all these tragedies? But I don't think it's unfair to say to members of Congress, where do you stand on registration, on closing these loopholes? Where do you stand on semi-automatic weapons and clips? Is it a magic bullet? It's not. But my frustration is we don't talk about them. We just have moments of silence, and then we do nothing. And that's what makes me crazy. That's why every time when the speaker said, you know, please stand for a moment of silence, that I want to walk out of the chamber, because I know what's going to happen after the moment's over. So I hope that changes in the House. We'll see. I'm pushing my party in that direction.
Speaking of voting and your party and pushing that forward, I'm curious, how do you see candidates like Connor Lamb elected in these moderate suburbs versus another young Democrat like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Is the Democratic Party a party where both of those types of candidates can coexist and push forward legislation they're both interested in?
Well, let me say, if it isn't, we'll never govern. This country has 435 congressional districts. Connor Lamb probably could not win a district in Queens, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez could never win Connor Lamb's district. Yet we share a lot of basic values together. When you look at the core values of Democrats, standing up for the poor, for the working class, for the middle class in the country, we might have different ideas on the best way to do that. But these are the things that bind us as a party. Yeah, we're a party that's very diverse, from the very far left over to our blue dogs and everything in between. But we have some common things that bind us, and I think it's around economic issues that Democrats, you know, that's our core message. And I want to see us govern because I think the majority of Americans are going to do better when we govern than when they govern. And if we're going to be able to govern, then yeah, we need Connor Lamb. These are the seats that we used to have. We're not going to get them back with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We're going to get them back with Connor Lamb's. So, you know, when we talk about a national message, that national message, I think, should always be around pocketbook issues. Then in each congressional district, you tailor that message, or you add to that message with those issues that are really germane in your district. And that varies from congressional district to congressional district.
Do you support Nancy Pelosi for speaker?
I wish we had choices, but you can't beat someone with no one. So yes, I do. I think at this time, we need some stability in the party too. My question is, if not Nancy, who? And the problem is there's no who. When I got elected, the Democrats had lost control of the Congress for the first time in 40 years. we had a complete slate of candidates to run against the incumbent slate of candidates. Every position, from the speaker all the way down to the last position, we had a choice to say, okay, who are we going to vote for? I voted for every one of the new people when I got there. I thought, hey, you just lost the Congress for the first time in 40 years. Why would I put you back in charge of my party? And I voted, and it was a secret ballot election, and probably good for me because every one of the guys I voted for lost, and the incumbents were all reelected. Here we have a situation when people say to me, you're going to vote for Nancy Pelosi. I always say, well, who's running against Nancy Pelosi? She's unopposed. Nobody's worked harder than Nancy Pelosi for the party. My question is, why don't we have a slate? Why haven't these next generation of Democrats that want to lead show some leadership and put themselves out there? But the fact of the matter is, no one has put themselves out there. Let me tell you something. It's a tough, thankless job, number one, yeah. In case people don't realize it. You give up whatever semblance of a family life you have to do this, because when you're not in session, your life is somebody else's. You're out in one of those congressional districts, or you're out raising money, or you're on the speaking circuit with the national news media. That's what these jobs entail. And you don't get a penny more to do it, and you get a whole bunch of grief because you've got, you know, your members of your party, all of them expect that, you know, you live to serve them. This isn't a job for a rookie. We need somebody that has the respect of the caucus and the gravitas to be in this type of position. Now, is Nancy going to be there forever? No, I really believe this would be her final term as the speaker. So I see this really as a transition year. And if nobody steps forward to run against them, my hope would be that we not have some silly exercise where we just burn the place down and have no backup plan.
Congressman Doyle, thank you so much for chatting with me.
My pleasure.
That's WESA's Lucy Perkins speaking with Democratic Congressman Mike Doyle. Democrats are scheduled to choose the Speaker of the House next week. You're listening to The Confluence.
I'm Megan Harris. Just ahead on The Confluence, Pittsburgh Filmmakers is proceeding with plans to sell its longtime Melwood Avenue headquarters and consolidating operations to Shadyside. What will their new business model look like, and who will be in charge? Plus, it takes 2 years to learn how to pull noodles and another 8 to master the skill. Hear how federal visa restrictions are limiting one local restaurant's ability to recruit for that highly specialized craft. Find this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and on Twitter at WESAConfluence, plus wherever you find your podcasts. This program continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Steel magnate Benjamin Franklin Fairless was featured on the cover of Time magazine this week in 1951. After presiding over various steel companies, he took over U.S. Steel, the largest producer of steel in the country. Fairless led U.S. Steel for years, including through a rapid production period spurred by World War II. When he retired a decade later, Life magazine called him the single most powerful figure in the country's basic industry. I'm Mick Stinelli for the Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh's busways cover nearly 20 miles, helping to ease the city's congested roadways. For our Good Question series, Katie Blackley looks at how the Martin Luther King Jr. East Busway changed commuting in Pittsburgh.
Listener Jay Walker recently started taking the East Busway to his friend's house in Edgewood at Hamnet Station.
And ever since I started going there, it's been very difficult to get on the bus, get off the bus quickly, and just go into his neighborhood. Why is it so difficult to get to Edgewood from the Hamnet Busway station?
The answer to Walker's question is woven into the history of the busway. Its story begins in the 1950s with the creation of the Port Authority of Allegheny County. One of the agency's first initiatives included the construction of two busways, one in the south and one in the east. The south busway, from the south side to Overbrook, opened first in the late 70s. This was a big deal. It was one of the first bus rapid transit systems in the country. Former Pittsburgh transportation reporter Joe Grata says when it came to finding a location for the east busway, the agency seized an opportunity with some land that was already being used for transit.
So they share that basically with the railroad, although the railroad's separate and Port Authority now has the ownership. what's really the East Busway right away.
Railroads weren't doing well in the 1960s, and the four tracks that ran through the heart of Pittsburgh were no exception. They sat on what's called a right-of-way. Private rail companies owned the land, which cut through city property. Gratta says Port Authority offered to buy the right-of-way from the government, who owned the railroad at the time, but it wasn't easy.
It took years for them to finally come to some agreement with the railroad as to the right-of-way.
Two of the four train tracks were converted to a concrete road for the East Busway. As a precaution against derailments, the busway was elevated. It was also widened in some areas to create a bypass lane for express service. Port Authority's Fred Mergner says when the 6.8-mile busway opened in 1983, it was an immediate success.
And it used to take almost an hour to get to Wilkinsburg, and you could get there in 15 minutes.
Thousands crowded the busway vehicles. Riders loaded at six stations from downtown to Wilkinsburg. Riding on the busway's popularity, Port Authority proposed an extension into the eastern boroughs of Edgewood, Swissvale, and Rankin. Joe Gratta says borough leadership at the time was hesitant to get on board.
Were these communities welcoming? Not always. Not everybody.
There was a public dispute between Port Authority and borough leadership over the extension. Patricia Schaefer sits on Edgewood Borough Council and says the eastern boroughs were watching the success of the new T route through the city's southern neighborhoods.
The eastern corridor really believed that it would be advantageous to all of the communities to have light rail.
These boroughs were frustrated that they weren't getting what they considered the same investment as those in the south. Some people were opposed for other reasons: noise, air quality, car and pedestrian traffic around the stations. But for Schaefer, it was always about the light rail. After a long public debate, Port Authority and borough leadership came to an agreement. There would not be light rail, but the possibility of its eventual construction would remain in Edgewood's contract. But there's still no station leading to Edgewood, which is what our listener Jay Walker encountered when he got off at Hamnet Station.
It takes like a few minutes to get from Edgewood to the bus stop, even though it's right next to the bus stop.
Unlike most bus stops that have access from both inbound and outbound stops, Hamnet only has an inbound exit. Outbound riders have to walk through a pedestrian tunnel and cross the busway to get to their stop. Port Authority says that's a result of the right-of-way being too thin for two stops. Still, the busway is used by thousands of commuters every day. It's a simple technology, but considering all the local buses that feed into the system, it's far-reaching. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh Filmmakers is continuing its reorganization with the sale of its longtime home on Melwood Avenue in Oakland. The deal is expected to be closed soon. Joining us to talk about how the move and the shift in focus might impact this venerable arts organization is WESA's arts and culture reporter, Bill O'Driscoll. Hey, Bill.
Good morning, Kevin.
Bill, remind us how Pittsburgh Filmmakers sort of got to this point, some financial troubles, et cetera.
They've had a long history of, for the past probably almost 15 years, of just losing students. As universities take some of these film education programs in-house, filmmaking programs in-house, they've been losing students, been losing independent students as well. So they've had financial crises, six-figure deficits for several years now.
And there's been a leadership change. The CEO resigned in July?
Yes, the latest CEO resigned in July, but they've had a leadership problems for going back 3 or 4 years now, and it's been kind of an ongoing turmoil there, a lot of layoffs and things.
That CEO, Jermaine Williams, I think resigned after about 18 months on the
Correct.
Job. Replaced by two people. Who are they and why so?
Well, they're both longtime employees of Filmmakers. Dorinda Sankey, who's the director of administration, has been there for like 30 years. And Kyle Hauser, who ran the studio arts program, has been there for, I think, 7 or 8 years. And so they're kind of jointly going to be running the place now. The board chose them and thought that they had the skills needed to do this job finally.
So you have business skills and programmatic skills.
Yes.
Okay. So where Pittsburgh Filmmakers going to set up shop?
They're going to... It's actually Pittsburgh Filmmakers, Pittsburgh Center for the Arts. They're a merged entity for the past 12 years now. They're going to consolidate over on the PCA campus, the Center for the Arts campus, on Fifth Avenue, which a lot of people know. It's that big yellow mansion at Shady and Fifth. They've got five buildings there. They say they have enough room to do what they want to do. The thing is, they're changing their business model, and this is the big news for filmmakers itself. For a long time, they've relied on college students running college credit classes to generate most of their income. They're not going to do that anymore because the schools have taken it all in-house. Filmmakers are going to return to its original mission, going back some 45 years of serving individual artists, members of the general public who want to do film photography, digital media.
So this physical move was just a logical step because of the merged organization.
The building, the Melwood Street building in Oakland was like 40,000 square feet, way too big for what they needed now, they say.
Okay. You were alluding to some of the changes in programs and services. Let's talk a little bit more about that and the effect on what filmmakers can offer in their new home, if you would. What are the limitations or the opportunities that they can offer at the big mansion, the Center for the Arts, big campus?
Well, they say the opportunities for them is that they don't have to now cater to what the universities want anymore. And this allows them the flexibility to do what just regular people who want to make art want to do, independent artists and things like that. So they're going to be focusing on, they think there's a desire to know how to make shorts for web, like digital shorts for web. They think that there's a desire for podcasting, for instance. So they're going to be offering classes in things like that. And seeing what works, seeing what people are interested in.
Okay, so more independent students rather than college students. What about the kids? They always have had an interest in kids. Is that the children's programs changing?
A little bit, yeah. They've offered summer arts camps for kids ages 4 to 17. They're no longer going to be offering for kids ages 4 to 8. They felt like their core focus should be on the kids that are, you know, later grade school, middle school, high school kids.
Mm-hmm. So all these changes, whether it's in terms of programs and services or physically moving their location, are these cost-cutting or cost-effective moves? Is that what they're intended to do as well?
Well, they're going to realize a good bit of money from the sale of the Melwood building.
Okay.
Probably close to $4 million off of that. Of course, they have some debts to pay. They've been living off a credit card for several years now. But they will end up with some money from that they're going to put toward programming and toward emergency funds and things along those lines. They have some capital improvements that need to be done at the PCA campus. Those are all old buildings, but they have some grant money that should be coming to them. They're also hoping to repair their relationship with funders, foundations, and so forth. They've been damaged over the last several years and hope to get back in the good graces of the foundations.
Okay, Bill, looking to the future, a couple quick questions. What's going to happen with Regent Square and Harris Theaters?
They're keeping those theaters. They're going to continue programming them. Of course, the Harris is owned by the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust downtown. That'll still be programmed. The Regent Square Theater up in Edgewood, which is kind of their flagship theater. They're going to keep programming that, and they're going to that's one of the places they're hoping to improve the building and just continue to do programming there that'll draw people in and benefit the neighborhood.
And finally, Three Rivers Film Festival coming back or not?
It's been sort of on hiatus for a couple of years now, effectively. It is supposed to be coming back next November. They have a new, in addition to the new leadership at the top of the organization, they have a new director of film programming named Joe Morrison, who's kind of a veteran of the local scene. And I think seems like a good choice to me to help remount that festival. So look for that a year from now. It's a little ways away yet. But
okay. Bill O'Driscoll is WESA's arts and culture reporter. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Immigrants with specialized skills can apply to work in the U.S. with an H-1B visa. But early in the Trump administration, officials capped the number of people who can receive that. Now it's affecting employers around the country, including Taiwanese restaurants in Pittsburgh. In a new series, the Post-Gazette explores the struggles faced by these establishments, including Everyday Noodles in Squirrel Hill, which relies mostly on foreign-born staff. We're joined in studio by Post-Gazette restaurant reporter and critic Melissa McCart, who actually traveled to Taiwan to report on this story. Melissa, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
And also in studio is immigration attorney Ellen Freeman. She's a partner in charge of the Pittsburgh office of Porter Wright. Welcome, Ellen.
Good morning.
Melissa, why did you feel it was important to write this story?
I guess it was this summer, I had been talking to a couple of Chinese restaurant owners, and they were talking about how challenging it is to hire staff. The restaurant industry is now the number one employer in Pittsburgh, and Chinese restaurants have specific skills that might be outside of the range of a new American restaurant, for example. Then in talking to Mike Chen, who is the owner of Everyday Noodles, he had essentially founded a restaurant based on specialized skills, knowing full well that he would not necessarily be able to hire local restaurant staff because they wouldn't necessarily have this one particular skill of pulling noodles. Why bring it to Pittsburgh? Essentially, we have an increase in Chinese students in all of the universities. I think there's close to 30% of CMU is Chinese right now. And he felt that there was an audience for it and a need for it, and that people who were not in the Chinese community would appreciate it too.
Okay, I want to get back to more of the specifics of the impact on this restaurant and the specialized skills necessary. But I want to clear up some and make sure we have the right grounding to talk about the importance of or what the restrictions are on the H-1B visas. Ellen, if I might, a few questions about those visas. What is the intended purpose of H-1B visas?
H-1B visa is a specialty occupation visa. While the definition for it is quite complex and allows a number of different people to qualify, the general perception is that it's a visa that requires 12 years of progressively responsible work experience, which is equivalent to a bachelor's degree. So a qualifying foreign national doesn't have to have a bachelor's degree to qualify for an H-1B visa. Both the Immigration Service and our Department of Labor view 3 years of work experience as equivalent to 1 year in college. So many different people qualify for the visa. It's not limited just to doctors or lawyers or licensed professions. One can have skills that are learned on a job, and that visa has been used quite a bit in the hospitality industry, both by managers and by chefs.
Do we have a sort of a misperception that, oh, these must be tech jobs that companies and industries can't fill?
Absolutely, especially with all of the publicity that the outsourcing industry brought onto the United States. We have heard that so many companies outsourced their jobs and took them to other countries, especially India mostly, but also to Eastern Europe. And the H-1B visa became toxic. It became associated with taking jobs from the United States, from foreign nationals, mostly Indian IT professionals coming here, training under the supervision of American workers and then taking the jobs away. And it shifted the focus from what the H-1B visa really intended to be. It almost requires an overhaul for people to understand that we do need and welcome foreign workers into the United States. We need their specialty, and we don't have to focus simply on who has a bachelor's degree.
Okay, and I wanted to ask another question, but have the changes restricted the numbers that are offered totally?
The Trump administration did not make changes to the numbers. It made significant changes in how those numbers are granted and whether we actually receive the numbers that are allotted to us by Congress. Nobody knows whether we actually issue the allotted number of H-1B visas, which is supposed to be 85,000 a year, 60,000 general quota, and then an additional 65,000, excuse me, and then 20,000 for graduates of American graduate schools, students who earned here a master's degree or a PhD degree, for example.
And what about, are they divided up across the country? This region gets so many or not?
Unfortunately not. It's just a general pool. And it's a lottery system that's a bit crazy. So all of the cases are filed in the first 5 business days of April, and they're mailed to 2 service centers in the country, one in California and one in rural Vermont.
Melissa, I wanted to bring this back to Pittsburgh. So we have this policy, how people are reviewing it, but how is this affecting Everyday Noodles, which is the focal point of your reporting here?
I think that once owner Mike Chen realized that there were these changes in immigration policy, he had hired a lawyer and felt that navigating work visas was overwhelmingly difficult, both in terms of the hours billed for that lawyer to figure out, you know, how the laws have changed and how he could secure workers from overseas. I think he's very concerned with adhering to the law. And so he felt that he had to come up with a plan B.
All right. So give us a sense. Everyday Noodles, tell us about the restaurant. I mean, I've been there, but tell us about what you see, what you sense when you get there.
What's so great about Everyday Noodles is it is authentic. It's not this concept of a dumpling restaurant. It is, you are watching people pull noodles. And this is a skill that might be the equivalent of being a really good athlete or playing the violin well. It takes 2 years to become proficient and well more than that to be able to make, you know, 500 bowls of noodles a day.
So it's the perfection of the making, but also the speed, because they seem to have a lot of customers.
Absolutely. Even 5 years after the restaurant has opened, there's a line. You'll be able to go on Thanksgiving and you will see people waiting out the door because they like the theater of it. And the texture is this sort of silky yet chewy noodle that is not something you could buy at Giant Eagle.
And the service, I mean, you're pretty nearby each other. You can sense, hold it, while I'm waiting for mine, my next door neighbor here, another customer who I don't know, they're getting theirs and you're sort of enjoying what they're seeing and eating.
Absolutely. I mean, I have been there many times where, you know, you're almost sharing a table with people you don't know. And I've learned that the people next to me had traveled from Ohio, or they might have come from, you know, Eastern PA or what have you. But it is a destination restaurant, not just for Pittsburghers, but for people outside of the area.
All right. Now, let's bring this back to the visas and the difficulty of hiring and finding. Are there no or very few master noodle makers? And how does that how is that impacted by the changes with H-1B visas? Ellen?
I think today we have general shortage of a lot of occupations, and especially in the Pittsburgh area, we know that Allegheny Conference reports we have hundreds of thousands of jobs that are going to go unfilled in the next 10 to 15 years, and we really need to welcome immigrants. Pittsburgh benefited greatly as a result of foreign students, especially those from Southeast Asia, who represent a very large percentage and contribute a lot to our market, and we don't have visas even for them to stay here. We started talking about STEM, how the H-1B visa generally disproportionately goes to STEM graduates. And what it does, it not only goes to graduates in the science, technology, engineering, or math, it also goes to male graduates, disproportionately affecting females who may be choosing professions in liberal arts or marketing, you know, social sciences, and those kinds of disciplines. We're not keeping them. And Pittsburgh is really focused on growing the population, growing the city, and keeping our foreign graduates here. There is no restaurant today, I think, in Pittsburgh, walk-through strip district, that doesn't have help wanted sign. Hospitality industry is especially affected when the market is hot and people are working in other professions, and when it's not summer that we can't even take benefit of our high school students or young adults working in Pittsburgh. I think today anybody who wants to work here can get a job.
I think the thing that I wanted to add to this is that having a robust immigrant community and immigrant businesses such as Everyday Noodles attracts people from other places to move to Pittsburgh. Everyday Noodles is an amenity for people who are considering moving to the area.
Yeah, let's get a little deeper into that, because I think people, they don't just take a job. They sort of choose a place to live, and the job is part of that, and the amenities are part of that.
Absolutely. A lot of the times when I try to welcome a new client into Pittsburgh, and I've been practicing immigration law here for 20 years now, I take them to different bakeries so that they find bread that they like, from Food Glorious Food to La Gourmandine to Madeline Bakery. I mean, Pittsburgh today has so much more than 25 years ago when I moved here. And when people find the bread they like and when they find restaurants they like, it definitely makes this community extremely welcoming and easy to adjust.
And I believe, Melissa, you reported on one of the restaurant's employees actually left the country.
Yes. Well, he couldn't stay. It was so wonderful. So one day when I was in Taipei, Mike and Grace Chen took me on the subway. We went fairly far, and we met this guy who was the executive chef at a different restaurant sort of outside of the city. And he and I started talking through Google Translate, essentially. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me how much he loves Pittsburgh, and he was showing me photos of skydiving over the city. As a matter of fact, he even got a tattoo of the Pittsburgh skyline on his forearm. He really wants to be a part of Everyday Noodles, but Mike Chen and his lawyer and this particular worker couldn't figure out a way for him to legally stay.
Briefly, we have 3 minutes left. Is there a way, or is that done for this particular employee?
I think there is a way, and we will try to explore it, or Michael Chen will look at other possibilities. But what I wanted to mention is that the H-1B visa gets so much criticism or so much negative publicity, and nobody talks about the backlogs in our green card system, and that people tend to use this visa because there is no opportunity to secure permanent residence for people who really want to stay here and live here. And that we need to, of course, look at our immigration system at all aspects of it and realize that H-1B visa sometimes used as a, you know, Band-Aid or a blanket, and it's only because we don't have other opportunities to keep people in the country.
And very briefly, have there been changes to the H-4 regarding spouses?
Unfortunately, we're expecting a publication of a notice in a Federal Register anytime now. We think that it will come in January, February, and it's just a vicious attempt to limit the number of foreign nationals living in the country.
So under H-4, spouses of H-1B holders could work or not?
Only a very limited number. Up to date, there have been only 90,000. There are many, many requirements that one has to meet to qualify for employment authorization and H-4 visa status.
Okay. In our remaining minute and a half, I want to talk about the overall impact on our culture, our region, about, you know, we want to be welcoming. So how does this impact that and the cultural contributions of other people adding to our region? Melissa?
I think that one of the responses that I've gotten since I've written the article is that somehow people who are here are not legal, and I think that the assumption should be that they are and that they're essentially enriching the community in some way, whether it's through their attendance at the universities or working in the restaurant industry.
Mm-hmm. Ellen, you were mentioning earlier you take people around, new potential clients and all that. Talk a little bit about that impact on our region's culture of people bringing and contributing something of their own.
Pittsburgh, unfortunately, has one of the lowest percentage of foreign-born. And for us to sustain and grow the population, we really do want to grow the foreign-born community here. We don't have a lot of them. And the mayor and the city council and the county commissioners have been all very welcoming to the initiatives. We are a sanctuary city, and we value every citizen living in our city and in our community. We want them to stay. We want them to make our community more welcoming, more inclusive, especially, unfortunately, in the wake of what happened in Tree of Life. And, you know, we know that we have a long way to go to really blend and make ourselves a very welcoming place. And places like Everyday Noodle definitely bring that warmth of that broth and the camaraderie that we see there table to table, elbow to elbow, to our community, and we want them to succeed.
Ellen Freeman is an immigration attorney. She's the partner in charge of the Pittsburgh office of Porter Wright. Melissa McCart is the food critic and restaurant reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, who traveled to Taiwan to cover this story. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, we'll explore the special relationship between the Jet Propulsion Lab, NASA, and a small community in Butler County. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mick Stinelli and Meg Fair. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Confluence returns Monday. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving.